Well, thank you all very much for coming. I don't know if you know the story about Michael Howard when he was Home Secretary, and he went to visit a prison, and the prisoners were arrayed in the prison yard for him to speak to, and there was the murderers and rapists and fraudsters and so on. And as he began to speak, he obviously realized he couldn't say, "I'm delighted to be in such distinguished company," which he normally did. And what he actually said was, "I'm so glad you're all here." Well, I think that goes for Raj and me. Now, we have both written books on the human condition. We thought we would advertise each other's book. Here's Raj's book. These have some things in common, but a slightly different perspective on one important issue, which is how far the state can increase our happiness. And so we thought it would be stimulating to have this debate or discussion, with you also participating. So I'm going to talk for 20 minutes. Raj will talk for 20 minutes, and then we'll have a general debate, hopefully short points, going on to 8, and we will stop promptly at 8 o'clock. Now, I think it's obvious that we need some sort of a state to be happy. We need some people to protect us on the streets and so on. And equally, of course, we don't want a state which interferes in everything, and that is why when you look at the results of happiness research, you see that the most unhappy societies that have been documented at all in these surveys are those in the Soviet Union or the former Soviet Union. They're much less happy, incidentally, than the countries in the Third World. So we're obviously talking about a state somewhere in the middle, a state like ours, and the question is, I think we could make it a practical question, could the kind of state that we have now operate so as to make us happier? Now, I've discovered since publishing my book that some people don't like this question to be asked. In fact, I had two reviews. One was called The Happiness Police, and the other was called The Bureaucrats of Bliss. These both took the line that if you ask what makes people happy and you actually find out the answers and then you say, well, why doesn't the state try and produce conditions that make people happier, that this is the road to the servile state. I think this whole reasoning is completely back to front, for the obvious reason that the servile state would make us miserable. So if we were trying to use the findings of research about what made people happy, we would not impose a servile state. Nor would we have an absolutely excessive amount of regulation. For example, red tape makes people miserable. You would only have more red tape if you thought the benefits to happiness outweighed the costs. So somewhere in between, you can have a perfectly reasonable debate about how the state could make people happier. I think that in thinking about this sort of thing, I mean, you have to start thinking about social organization. You have to start from the idea that the fundamental idea is individual autonomy. People like to feel they have control over their lives. They also know a lot more about themselves than other people do in a general way. And that's why voluntary exchange is a wonderful basis for happy forms of social exchange. But life is complicated. And there's a huge amount of involuntary exchange. I mean, we're picking up our norms from other people, whether we want to or not. We're reading their advertisements. We're having our purses nicked. So many forms of involuntary interaction also go on. And that's the first role for the state, to see how those could be made more wholesome, the involuntary interactions. And the second, of course, is to protect the weak. So just taking those two basic principles, let's think about how the state could do better to produce a happier society, which I think it could, and I think it's the way we should think about our problems in Britain. So I just want to give you four examples of how we could have a happier society if the state listened to what we were saying. I'm going to start with mental health because I thought that might interact with Raj's position. And then I'm going to go on to work, income and values. I've actually been rather active on this mental health issue for the last 6 months since I finished the book, because I thought it'd be an interesting question to ask, who are the least happy people in Britain? And from the National Child Development Study, you can take out the people who say they are the least happy. And then you can try and find out in what ways they differ from the rest of us. And it is certainly true that, for example, they're 2.5 times more likely to be poor than the rest of us. But what about mental health? They're 4 times more likely to be mentally ill and have had a previous record of mental illness than the rest of us. So that is, if you like, the typography of the most miserable people in our country. And unfortunately, this is not the way the government has been thinking up to now. Psychiatry and psychology have been Cinderella sections of the NHS. If you have blood pressure, I have, or a skin problem, or asthma, or diabetes, or whatever, you will almost automatically at some point see a specialist, but not if you have a crippling depression, which is stopping you from working for a year. You're extremely unlikely to see a specialist. Not more than 10% of people in that condition will see a specialist. And this reflects, I think, our obsession at the moment with, quote, objective indicators rather than the feelings of people, which are what I believe matter most of all. So it's encouraging that by pointing out some of these facts, there is now a move going on in the government to provide more psychological therapy, which is, of course, what these patients want. They just don't want to be put on a few pills by the GP and sent off home. Now, while I'm on the NHS, I'd like to make another observation from Canada. It's very interesting that the Canadians have decided that one of the objectives of their National Health Service should be to satisfy the patients. Can you imagine it? And then they try to find out what satisfies the patients, what do the patients want from the NHS. And actually, they don't only want to be cured, they want to be treated as proper human beings with dignity and so on. And now Canada has made that one of the main objectives of their health service, to improve the percentage of people who are satisfied with the service. Let me go on to work. All happiness surveys show that unemployment is one of the greatest causes of unhappiness, similar in the size of its effect to the effect of being divorced or bereaved, and actually 3 times worse in its effect than, for example, losing as much as 30% of your income. So that's why any civilized society tries to reduce unemployment as far as possible. Now, there's two sorts of unemployment, the cyclical and structural unemployment. And one of the great achievements of the last 50 years has been to reduce the amount of cyclical unemployment, the sort of thing that you saw in the Great Depression, to the lowest level that we know of in the history of industrial societies. This is a tremendous achievement, but of course structural unemployment is still very high in some countries, France, Germany, Spain. And I don't know if Raj is going to talk about it, but there's a chapter in his book about it here where he's arguing, and I agree with him, that particularly in France and Germany, a lot of that unemployment is due to inappropriate benefit policies giving people benefits without attaching any conditions that they should accept jobs that are different from the ones they did before. So you've seen in France and Germany the coexistence of very high unemployment with often very high vacancies. I think that's wrong. I think it's based on the wrong philosophy for a welfare state, where people are seen as victims and they're not expected to take steps to improve themselves, even if they may be less than ideal. And as I've just shown you from the evidence, almost any work is better than no work. And that's what the authorities who try to help unemployed people should be allowed to take into account. And in fact, that's of course what happens in some of the low unemployment countries in Europe, Denmark, Netherlands, and Britain. They have done, followed the policy of expecting people to take different jobs from the ones they did before, but they've also taken on to the government the responsibility for offering activity to everybody within a year of becoming unemployed. We don't quite have that yet in Britain, but they have in Denmark and the Netherlands, and I think that is exactly the right way of thinking about how to produce a happy and healthy working situation for people. Let me move on to income. I've said it's less important than work, but of course people worry a lot about money, and income does matter to people. But, and this has been a long-standing insight of economics, but now we can put numbers on it. In fact, Guy here has been working with me on this. We can now see from these surveys, where you measure how happy people are and what income they have, you can see how additional income increases a person's happiness. And you can see that if somebody's already got a 100,000, an extra pound in the pocket is worth only one-tenth to them what it is to somebody who's only got 10,000. So this is a very important issue, bearing on the appropriate income distribution in a country, and of course it's the main argument for redistribution. It's an argument for redistribution within a country. It's even more of an argument for redistribution of the kind that's being talked about at Gleneagles. Now, if income makes us happier, of course, things which make us want more income make us less happy. And, of course, that's advertising. And it seems to me that the kind of pictorial advertising which we're exposed to all the time, and our children, are making people feel less and less satisfied with any particular amount of money that they have. It's particularly bad when it's directed at children. Sweden has banned advertising directed at children under 12. I think there's quite a case in our own country for not only that, but also considering whether pictorial advertising, if it has these bad effects, ought to be settable against corporation tax. Finally, let me end on values. Some people think values are a private matter. Of course, they never have been. In every society, people have been concerned with the values which other people's children absorb, because they affect all of us. So it's very important what kind of values are being offered to our children in our schools. Now, in a recent WHO survey, this is of 11 to 15 year olds, they were asked, do you agree with the statement that most of the students in my classes are kind and helpful? Here's the answers. Sweden, 77%, yes. Germany, 76. Denmark, 73. USA, 53. Russia, 46. England, 43. Now, I think that this is a pretty depressing picture, and it corresponds rather closely to another set of questions which have often been asked of the population, namely, do you think most other people can be trusted? And in Scandinavia, again, you're up in very high numbers, and in Britain, much lower, and in both Britain and the USA, the numbers saying yes have halved in the last 40 years. And I attribute this to the growth of individualism. And it's interesting that on the continent, the numbers of people who think other people can be trusted has not fallen over the last 30 years for which we have data. So by individualism, I mean the belief, which I think is becoming increasingly spread about by teachers, parents, media, that your main duty is to make the most of yourself, make the most of your life. This may be where we're going to disagree. The extreme version of this is that your job is to get ahead of other people. If you go into the Department of Education, or did for about a year, I don't know if it's still there, or two horrible posters, higher than this backdrop here, both of which say, staying ahead. Apparently that's the aim of the educational system. I think that this is just too stressful for people. And of course, getting ahead is of course, a completely hopeless objective for a society, because it's impossible for everybody to get ahead of everybody else. It's a zero-sum game, and we shouldn't be getting people putting their energy into zero-sum games. But even just to make the most of yourself is very stressful, rather than to do things which engage you and enable you to help other people. So I want our schools to teach people that their job is to contribute to the happiness of others and to find happiness from doing that. I think that should be the basis of our personal and social education. If you read these books on emotional intelligence, they have quite good curricula which could be adopted in schools. I think they would not only help people to manage their own feelings, but they would help them to relate better to other people, which would be good for the other people. My feeling, however, is that it's difficult for schools on their own to change a society or to change a culture. So I'm currently looking, in case there happens to be anybody here, I'm looking for a city. I think you could do this perhaps more at the level of a city. If you could get a city to decide that its aim was to be a friendly city in which people felt the world was a friendly place, that was taught in schools, that was the ethos of local services, how they related to citizens, ethos of the police, ethos in the NHS, if that was what employers thought was their job, to help to enable their workers to lead satisfying lives and to feel that the world was on their side. I think we could do an interesting experiment, because we could measure the outcomes. You know, what is this doing to mental health admissions? What is this doing to offending rates? What is this doing to various survey measures? And I don't see why we shouldn't have a local government that tried to help its people to be happier. Now, Albert Einstein once said that the key question is whether the universe is a friendly place. I think that's a rather big question, but I do think that the key question is whether the world is a friendly place, and I do think the government can do a lot to determine how we answer that question. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard. And thanks for inviting me to the LSE. Harold Macmillan, a former British Prime Minister from several decades ago, was visiting France on a state visit and happened to find himself with a few private moments with the wife of President Charles de Gaulle, Madame de Gaulle. He asked her what she was most looking forward to on the retirement, the imminent retirement, of President Charles de Gaulle. He was somewhat startled and shocked at her reply. When asked what she was most looking forward to on President de Gaulle's retirement, she said, a penis. It was only later on reflection that Macmillan realized that what she was trying to say under a heavy French accent was happiness. And right there, you have the problem at the heart of happiness. Which is that when people are talking about it, they're not often talking about exactly the same thing. Now, Richard Layard has done some important work with this profound book in that he has reorientated the project of politics and economics towards emotions and well-being. And in so doing, he's pushing psychology into the center of public policy. And also, for example, on page 233 of this important book, he says, "We should spend more on tackling the problem of mental illness. This is the greatest source of misery in the West, and the fortunate should ensure a better deal for those who suffer. Psychiatry should be a top branch of medicine, not one of the least prestigious." Well, it would be very difficult for me, and indeed churlish of me, to argue with that. And in taking issue with some of what's in the book, I want to emphasize I don't want to refute a lot of what he says, but perhaps try to deepen and broaden the debate and the argument. I will take issue with some of the things he says in the book. In particular, I will take issue with his definition of happiness, the way it's measured, and whether we should take personal responsibility for our own happiness. But he has done an important thing in drawing attention to the fact that the social sciences in general have rather neglected the issue of emotions. And that is because emotions traditionally have been difficult to measure, and whenever scientists find something difficult to measure, they tend to neglect it. But now the science of measurement of happiness, as he documents in his book, has made great strides. For example, recent brain scanning research has located the happiness center in the brain. And just in case you're looking for it, it's the left prefrontal superior cortex. But happiness isn't just a real thing, as spotted on brain scanning studies. It's actually a real biological entity. Happy people smell differently to unhappy people. A recent study did an experiment where psychologists took people and showed them funny films that would cheer them up, or showed them horror films that would scare them, and took swabs, gauze swabs of their armpits while they were watching these films. They then gave these gauze swabs to a completely independent group of people a week later and asked them to smell them. And this independent group of people could reliably identify the happy people as opposed to the scared people. So happiness is a real biological entity. Happy people smell differently to the rest of us. Now, just because something can be measured doesn't necessarily mean it's important. Aristotle, way back 2,000 years ago, argued that actually happiness was the central issue in our lives. And his argument went something along the lines of this. He said that when you ask people why they do stuff, like, for example, why they earn money, why they go to work, why they get married, they always say ultimately they do these things because they think these things will make them happy. But when you ask them, why are you trying to be happy, they never have another purpose, another cause beyond the pursuit of happiness itself. Since all pathways of human activity therefore lead causally in terms of reasoning as to why people do stuff back to happiness, then happiness, he argued, must be the ultimate goal in life. And that argument has kind of more or less stood fairly unchallenged for about 2,000 years of Western thought, but it has begun to be recently challenged by evolutionary biologists, who argue that actually there is a purpose beyond the pursuit of happiness in life. And that is based on the idea that we are biologically wired up in our genes, in our brains, to experience emotions because these emotions help us survive and help us pass on our genes to future generations. So take the emotion of fear. Fear and anxiety are deeply unpleasant emotions. Yet our ancestors, in experiencing fear and anxiety, these emotions help them avoid things like the edges of cliffs and predators bounding towards them. And because they avoided these things, they lived to pass on these genes to future generations. And that explains why neurosis exists. Neurotic people, millions of years ago, were extra vigilant for hazards in the local environment compared to non-neurotic people. And because of the extra vigilance, they actually did detect a few hazards, and that helped them pass on their genes to future generations. And this explains things like why people today, for example, are much more afraid of BSE than being run over on the road. Millions of years ago, poisoned meat did exist. So maybe we're genetically wired up to be particularly vigilant for that kind of hazard, whereas millions of years ago, there was no such thing as a Range Rover. And that explains why we're not afraid of Range Rovers as perhaps we should be today. Now, in order to understand the evolutionary purpose of happiness, you need to understand what psychologists believe happiness is constituted of. And psychologists believe you can dissect happiness into two basic key components, referred to, for want of a better word, as level one happiness and level two happiness. And when I use the terms level one and level two, I don't mean in any sense to say that level two is in some way a better form of happiness than level one. But basically, level one happiness is the kind of hedonistic pleasure that you get from a nice glass of wine, seeing a nice film, having a nice meal. And that's a feeling state, a pleasurable state. It tends to be rather intense, but it tends to be rather temporary. Indeed, psychologists have attempted to measure how long level one happiness lasts, and generally speaking, it lasts around 15 minutes. There is another kind of happiness, though, called level two happiness. This is a more cognitive, intellectual element of happiness. And this is the kind of satisfaction and contentment you feel when you look at your life and think about past achievements and think about the general direction that your life is heading in. Now, that form of happiness is less intense than level one happiness, but it is longer lasting. Now, the reason why it's very important to think about level two happiness as well as level one when we're talking about happiness goes back to William James, who was one of the founding fathers of psychology. He put it like this. He said, "If merely feeling good could decide the state of well-being, then mild drunkenness would be the supremely valid human experience." Notice something very important about level one and level two happiness. They are frequently in conflict with each other. If you do too much level one happiness, and I know that many students here at the LSC won't be doing that, then you won't really be able to get to achieve much level two happiness. Also, if you dedicate your life purely to level two happiness, then you won't experience much level one happiness, and maybe your life will be lacking something as a result. The key thing is that level one happiness is more intense, yet more fragile and temporary than level two happiness, which in contrast is less intense, but tends to last longer. Now, let's say we were to measure the happiness of people in this room and score it on a scale between 1 and 10. What you would find is a large group of people would be scoring around 6 on this 1 to 10 scale of happiness, where 10 was ecstatic happiness and 1 was suicidal despair. Let's call the people who are hitting around 6 the mildly content. There'll be some people out there listening to my words as I speak who'll be hitting 10, who'll be deliriously ecstatic as I'm talking. And these people really need to get out more. Now, what's really fascinating is if we were to measure these people's happiness in about a year's time, we would discover that the mildly content, the people scoring around 6, would, lo and behold, still roughly be scoring around 6 in about a year's time. But the people who are scoring 9 or 10, they're very unlikely to be scoring 9 or 10 in a year's time. Their happiness is much more intense, but much more fragile, and they're likely to be hitting 0, 1, or 2 in around a year's time. In other words, they're basically people who don't vary that much on levels of happiness, but in the intensity at which they experience happiness. Some people's lives are a roller coaster ride of emotions. They're swinging from one extreme to the other, where there's another group of people who are much more stable, and they're hitting around 4, 5, or 6. Now, here is the answer to one of the great secrets of happiness. And that is, if you want sustained well-being in the long run, you need to aim to hit around 6, and not aim to hit around 10. That is a great secret at the heart of happiness, and that means the secret at the heart of happiness is to aim for mild contentment. Now, you can see why publishers aren't too keen on that secret. Imagine Richard had written a book, the title of which was Mild Contentment. How many publishers would be gagging at publishing that? How many politicians would be standing for office saying, I stand for mild contentment? But there is an important point there, which is that it may well be that what we need to debate is not just how much happiness people have or the intensity experience, but what is sustainable in the long run. And this issue of the intensity of the happiness people aspire to is often ignored in the debate. Another interesting difference between level one and level two happiness is their temporal nature, in the sense that level one happiness is about your experience of living in the moment. It's very present-oriented, whereas level two happiness is about looking back at the past. It's about a reviewing of the past. And this is very well described by a Greek philosopher called Solon, who lived around 600 BC. And he expressed this retrospective aspect of satisfaction in a strong form when he wrote that no man could be described as happy until he was dead. Now, what's really interesting about Solon is that this begins a long strand of Western intellectual thought where intellectuals and academics begin to think about happiness and basically become happiness pessimists. They don't really subscribe to the idea that happiness is something we should subscribe to or aspire to. What I'm going to do is read out some quotes from Western intellectuals and see if you can identify who they are. This one is, one feels inclined to say that the intention that man should be happy is not included in the plan of creation. That was Freud. Freud also said, the best that can be hoped for in life was the transformation of hysteric misery into common unhappiness. Here's another quote. The existentialist says at once that man is in anguish. That's Sartre. Throughout the ages, the wisest of men have passed the same judgment of life. It is no good. Nietzsche. I don't know why we're here, but I'm pretty sure that it's not in order to enjoy ourselves. Wittgenstein. Today it is bad, and day by day it will get worse. Until at last the worst of all arrives. Schopenhauer. Man hands on misery to man. It deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can and don't have any kids yourself. Philip Larkin, the great poet. Now, what's really interesting, in contrast to intellectuals and academics who are happiness pessimists, what happens when you look at what people, ordinary people on the street, feel in terms of happiness? And you discover really something quite astonishing, that most ordinary people rate themselves as really rather happy. Let's take the National Child Development Study, a study that Richard's already alluded to. This was a study of all children born in the UK between March 3rd and March 9th, 1958, followed up ever since then and studied intensively. And there are around 12,000 people in that panel. By the year 2000, they had reached the age of 42, which is the peak age for the midlife crisis. They were asked to rate their happiness on a scale of 1 to 10. The results are stunning. More than 90% of the 12,000 respondents chose 5 or above. More than half of them chose 8, 9, or 10, with 8 the most frequent choice overall. When happiness is kind of rated on these scales, the average number that most people in most countries score is around 7.5. In most countries, the self-professed happy outnumber the unhappy by a ratio of 3 to 1. Another recent study done in Finland, following up roughly 30,000 Finnish adults, found that 80% of this sample rated themselves as fairly or very happy, whereas only 8% of the sample rated themselves as fairly or very unhappy. In other words, happy Finns outnumbered unhappy Finns by a ratio of almost 10 to 1. So, generally speaking, there's a lot of happiness out there. And maybe one of the problems with Richard's project is right there, which is that given that people really are rather happy as they are, maybe it's going to be very difficult on average to raise their happiness any higher. And statisticians call that a ceiling effect. Here is another bit of news that newspaper editors and book publishers won't like. maybe there's so much happiness out there in modern capitalist Western liberal societies that I'm afraid to tell you, basically, this could be as good as it gets. However, Switzerland, the country that scores highest on average happiness, the average score for happiness in Switzerland on a scale from 0 to 10 is an astonishing 8.39. And the statisticians think that basically means either there are no discontented people in Switzerland at all, or some people, when filling out the forms, are cheating and are so deliriously happy they're putting a number down higher than 10. Now, the intellectuals, who are more happiness pessimists, come up with a different argument. They say maybe why you're detecting all this happiness out there is because when you ask people how happy they are, when they respond, they're not really thinking very clearly or sensibly about their answer. So they're not giving you really a very profound answer. And there's a clue that that might be right from another interesting study done recently by psychologists. They engineer a situation where people have to go and make some photocopies from a photocopying machine. Unbeknownst to these people, they don't know the experimenter has engineered it, that they will discover a 10-cent dime on the photocopying machine, an unexpected discovery. So one group find the 10-cent dime, the other group who are photocopying don't find anything. Then they're interviewed shortly afterwards about how happy they are. But the happiness question doesn't ask them how happy you are right now. It asks them, tell us how you evaluate how happy your whole life has been. In other words, they ask people to evaluate happiness over their whole lifetime. The amazing result is the discovery of a 10-cent dime piece on a photocopying machine statistically significantly raises your assessment of how happy your whole life has been. The implications are dramatic for government policy. It suggests the cheapest and most effective public policy measures imaginable. But here you see a secret as to the difficulty in raising people's happiness, which is it was the unexpected nature of the discovery that raised their happiness. And that's one of the problems. How do you make it unexpected that people have positive events if it's the unexpected nature that adds to the happiness? Well, yes, but how could great thinkers like Freud and Wittgenstein get it so wrong? How could it be they could be such happiness pessimists and ordinary people are scoring so high on happiness? Well, the psychiatrist has an answer for that. It says, actually, you just need to look at these intellectuals and academics to understand why they're so pessimistic, because they're very different from ordinary people. Basically, they're what we call neurotic. They're introverted, they think a lot, they obsess, they ruminate, they're socially isolated, and no wonder that kind of mental equipment predisposes them to be rather pessimistic about life. In other words, ironically, the very people who appear to be most qualified to comment on happiness are actually the least qualified. But there's another interesting difference between intellectuals and the rest of the population, which is that intellectuals tend to be what psychologists call internal in orientation. Internality and externality are two key dimensions that psychologists feel you can divide the population over. Internals are people who take responsibility for their lives. They believe that they can have an impact on the future of their life, on their destiny, and they believe their destiny is in their hands. Externals, on the other hand, believe that their life is down to external forces beyond their control, and they have very limited ability to control their future. This key dimension has a profound effect on behavior. Internals tend to vote. Externals tend not to vote. Internals vote because they believe they can have an impact on the political system. Internals tend not to commit crime because they believe in the value of hard work. Externals don't believe in the value of hard work, so they tend to take shortcuts. And externals are more prone to various psychological problems. Now, here's the fascinating result. A psychologist called Gene Twenge, based in the US, has been looking, doing a meta-analysis of internality and externality in the population way back to the 1960s, the early 60s, when it first began to be measured. And she has discovered an alarming shift in the general population on this dimension, to the extent that the general population has shifted alarmingly in the direction of more externality, to the extent that the average young person today, around the age of an LSE student, is more external than 80% of people of the same age around in the early 60s. That is a dramatic shift in externality. And it has dramatic implications for happiness, which we'll come to in a second. But one of the questions is this: why is the population getting more external? Why is it they're not taking personal responsibility for their lives? Now, there are various theories. One profession that is blamed are the lawyers. The lawyers have this interesting habit of coming up to you at a cocktail party and saying things like, "I happen to notice you're really rather overweight. Let me sue McDonald's for you, because it's quite clear these big fast food corporations have made you overweight." As you trip over your paving stone outside your front door, a lawyer will appear magically and press his card into your broken hand and say, "Let me sue the local council for you for placing this paving stone to trip you up right here." So it's the rise of the blame culture that might be pushing the population in a more external direction. There's another interesting profession that are blamed, and that is people like Richard and myself, social scientists, psychologists, and psychiatrists. The idea here is the rise of the social science explanation is squeezing out personal responsibility. That people now say, "Well, you know, it's my genes that made me do it. It's my childhood. It's my dreadful parents. It's the terrible school I got sent to. It's society that made me do it." And this squeezing out of personal responsibility means that people are much more external in orientation. And it has dramatic implications for happiness, because externals feel happier in the short run, because when bad things happen to them, they can always blame someone else for why it happened to them. But in the long run, because they don't take personal responsibility for their lives, they're not going to be successful. Internals have a tougher time in the short run. When they go for a job interview and they fail it, and they take personal responsibility for the failure, they feel terrible in the short run. But because they take personal responsibility for their lives and work harder, in the long run, life is better for them. They do better, certainly, on level two happiness. Now we come to the key point about the evolutionary purpose of level one or level two happiness. It's obvious evolutionarily why we have level one happiness. It's obvious why we're genetically programmed to derive pleasure from sex and from eating, because those things help pass on our genes. But level two happiness, no other animal in the animal kingdom experiences level two happiness, because we are the only animals that can think and can plan for the future. So we are the only people who are able to experience level two happiness. So might it not be that actually that's kind of important? It's kind of important that we sometimes choose difficult challenges that we then overcome and we grow as a result. And actually, our key evolutionary advantage over every other species is the fact that we could suspend level one happiness, plan for the future, do difficult stuff today that led to personal growth. Aldous Huxley, 1932, penned a novel called Brave New World, which penned a chilling futuristic vision of an all-powerful state in which the masses are kept under control with a drug called Soma, which banishes all unhappiness. Many have seen Soma as a prophetic anticipation of Prozac. Liberal quantities of Soma ensure that everyone is content, well-behaved, and free from any disruptively original or subversive thoughts. Should anyone feel a tinge of dissatisfaction or anxiety, they are told to take a gram of Soma, which is said to have all the advantages of Christianity and alcohol, but none of their defects. Only one character in Huxley's novel, the savage, is recognized to be human, and he claims the right to be unhappy. At the end of Brave New World, the rebel, John, otherwise known as the savage, confronts the controller. Universal happiness, the controller admits, has been achieved by shifting the emphasis away from truth and beauty and towards comfort. Art and science have become impossible because they require challenge, skill, and frustration. Happiness has got to be paid for somehow, and the guarantee of comfort requires losing other experiences that are part of being human. Says the savage, "But I don't want comfort. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want goodness. I want sin." "In fact," said the controller, "you're claiming the right to be unhappy." Continues the controller, "Not to mention the right to grow old and ugly and impotent, the right to have syphilis and cancer, the right to have too little to eat, the right to be lousy, the right to live in constant apprehension of what may happen tomorrow, the right to catch typhoid, the right to be tortured by unspeakable pains of every kind." There was a long silence. "I claim them all," said the savage at last. Thank you.
Well, now it's your turn. I think we want short, pithy, either questions or challenges.
Whatever would make you happy, Richard.
Exactly. Or you. Who wants to go first? Don't be shy. Yes.
Thank you. My question is, could the speaker answer, do you think modern people are happier than ancient people? I mean, what makes society modern? I think the crucial thing is technology, but as we know, technology is always a mixed blessing. So that's the question, thank you.
It's a good question, and it's a question that the media in particular are often asking. They're asking, are we getting more depressed? And interestingly enough, it's a difficult question to answer because you get two different answers depending on which literatures, I would argue, you look at. If you look at the happiness literature, things like the Eurobarometer survey, when people are measuring happiness levels in the population at large, I would argue, and it'd be interesting to hear Richard's take on this, that generally the data suggests that basically happiness in modern wealthy Western societies has not really deviated much on average over the last 30 or 40 years, which is surprising because we've definitely got a lot wealthier. And that's certainly one of Richard's questions, which is, if economic growth is so important, how come it's not really having that much impact on people's well-being? But if you look at the depression literature, which is a completely different research tradition, there is a little bit of evidence that there may be, and it's a very difficult question to answer because to do the study properly, you have to go on back and ask people with the right depression questionnaires back in the 60s and 50s, the same question you're asking them now. There isn't strong evidence that generally speaking, I think large numbers of people are getting more depressed, but there is some evidence that particular groups of people seem to be more prone to depression. Worryingly, adolescents seem to be much more prone to depression today than 30 or 40 years ago. The latest data suggests that 1 in 5 young people attending British schools are suffering from a psychiatric symptom severe enough to warrant a clinical diagnosis, which is an astonishingly high number. And women aged between roughly 20 and 40 appear to be less happy than people of that age maybe 30 or 40 years ago. We could get into a debate of why those two groups in particular are prone maybe to more depression. But I hope that's an answer to your question.
Okay, I'll just add. Of course, we have from these surveys, say the World Value Survey covers poor countries as well as rich countries. And we know that poor countries are less happy than rich countries. And we also know that from the small number of poor countries where we've got data over time, that as those countries have become richer, they have become happier. So the picture seems to be much more this, as far as income is concerned, that if you're at all near the breadline, it's really important to become richer. Within those countries, within India, for example, income differences produce much bigger differences in happiness than they do in Britain. But as you get so far away from subsistence, you get to a situation where people are comparing their incomes with each other much more than with a subsistence requirement. And then, of course, it's impossible for the relative income of society to improve relative to itself, and that's how you get this flat effect in countries, in first world countries. Of course, another very long-standing issue is the noble savage. From Rousseau and others, you have the idea that civilization is an encumbrance and that the happiest thing is to be in a primitive society, essentially. On the whole, I think that's been shot apart by the more sensible archaeologists, anthropologists. I mean, they've shown that unbelievable death rates from fighting very many primitive societies, leaving aside altogether, you know, the costs in terms of happiness of disease, mortality, and fear, witchcraft, etc. So, I think we should be rather proud of our society. I don't think we should think that we've got the worst of all worlds. I think we've probably got just about the best of all worlds that have been. But I'm also quite sure we could be better. And I think that the variety of happiness reports in different advanced countries is interesting. I mean, in general, the Scandinavian countries and Switzerland come out in many, many surveys as happier than the rest of the advanced world. They come out as more trusting, and I think they have better and more equal human relationships. And I think what we've discovered is that income at our level of income is unimportant relative to human relationships, and we shouldn't be sacrificing human relationships in the name of GDP. Sorry.
Lots of other questions, I think.
We have to discipline ourselves. Right.
Thank you. There's another much less quoted novel by Aldous Huxley called Island, where he depicts his vision of utopia rather than dystopia, and where actually societal norms and customs include youngsters taking another kind of drug, which is called moksha rather than soma, which allows them to experience a higher level of happiness, something like the fusion of level one and level two happiness, if you want to call it that. And that's basically something that is, on the island, government policy. So do you think there is any way in which government can adopt measures to sort of reconcile level one and level two happiness? Thank you.
Well, what are the points I'm trying to make is that I think happiness is a complicated thing. It's a complicated thing to measure. It's a complicated thing to decide how happy people really are when they answer that question. And given it's so complicated, and when people are asked about the different pathways by which they might achieve happiness, they come up with as many different answers as they are individuals. I'm worried about the notion that governments should be charged with the responsibility of determining our happiness. I agree completely with Richard, and Richard focuses on an issue, which is, let's look at the unhappiest people in society, and what can we do about them? Could we not get really a maximum bang for our buck in terms of improving the well-being of society by focusing on that group of people? And what's very important about his book is he's trying to draw attention to a group of people that are dispossessed and often receive very little attention in society. And one of the great achievements of his book is asking the question, what would make the biggest difference to emotional well-being in society at large? And he naturally inclines himself, therefore, to focus on people who are really doing really badly. But not just doing badly in terms of the economic pyramid, but doing badly in terms of the happiness pyramid, as it were. So my central thrust, though, excluding that group of people who I do think we should help and assist, because actually I think they can't take personal responsibility for their happiness, but for the vast majority of the rest of us, I think we should be educated about the happiness literature, about the dangers of pursuing level one happiness over level two happiness, and then people should be free in a liberal society, because I'm a libertarian at heart, to decide how they're going to prosecute that course. And obviously, this is the high cost of a liberal society. Some people are going to make some really bad decisions on that front. But I defend to the end the freedom of the individual to make some really bad decisions, as long as it doesn't impinge on the freedom of others. I don't know, Richard, you wanted to come back?
Well, I wrote the word I wrote down was smoking. Forgetting secondary smoking. Do you really think that if we knew something was bad for somebody, it would be quite wrong to tax it more heavily? It seems to me that this is a principle which we actually do accept in our society, and I think it has a lot of quite general application. I mean, I stress the problem of having a society in which we had developed a value system of people trying to get ahead of each other, which is impossible because it's a zero sum. And I think it's a real issue. It's actually an almost inevitable public issue, how you view that. You see, you can say the state shouldn't get into that, but the state is in it. I mean, should the state publish league tables of schools? Should it reward the head teacher of a school according to how the school does in the league tables? What will the head teacher then do? Reward the teachers according to how they do. What will the teacher then do? Impress upon the children the absolute essential point of having a good performance in the league table. And so that the state can take a view, absolutely inevitably has to take a view, and how competitive or cooperative a set of values it wants its actions to promote in the society. And I really worry that if you take a as it were a libertarian point of view, it tends to lead to the very individualistic point of view and the very competitive end of the spectrum, and I don't think that's going to produce a happy society.
I was just wondering what. Oh, sorry. Thank you. I was wondering what sort of role does you what is your take on entertainment in modern society today, and its role on creating happiness, or sort of that would be the first question. And the second question, you talked about public policy. Surely public policy would be concerned with prioritizing some over others. In doing that, it's also essential to know whose happiness would be strengthened more by the same sort of resources. So if you give £1 to one person, how much is that? How much happier is that person compared to another one? But that certainly raises the question of how do you compare people's happiness? You can put them on a scale from 0 to 10, how themselves evaluate their happiness. But is that the same as comparing one person to another?
Well, I mean, the let me just repeat the problem. I mean, the problem is, if you ask a lot of people to put themselves on scale 0 to 10, are they interpreting the scale in the same way? One piece of evidence that they are is that you can find a lot of factors which explain where people have put themselves on the scale. For example, you will find, as I said before, that unemployment will put people lower on the scale, and so on. So that this is a variable which you can explain a great deal of the variation of. And you can also explain the variation across countries by relevant variables. So it suggests again that people, even in different countries, are using these scales in the same way. I think that the results which you get by assuming that people meant what they said are pretty meaningful, and I think it's really interesting that if you actually just plot on a graph, as my friend Guy has done here, you just plot the happiness level again. If you put somebody's income along here and you plot the happiness levels, you'll see a nice curve that goes like that. That after a while, extra income isn't making you happier, but when you're really poor, it does. I think these are really important findings, and I think to be able to put numbers on them is the beginning of a complete revolution in public policy making, actually, because, I mean, I don't mind forecasting that in 30 years' time, we wouldn't be debating this. This would be just the way things were done.
Well, just picking up on the question, I think it's a really good question about the issue of the entertainment industry and its impact on happiness, because there are several different ways in which the theory would be, and in fact, which has written about this in his book, that the entertainment industry would have a negative impact on society's happiness. One is just about the value system it espouses, which tends towards superficial values, and generally speaking, that's not great for your society. But there are a couple of other interesting things, which is that entertainment, by and large, tends to move people towards passivity. You passively sit on your sofa at home and consume television. And all the happiness literature is fairly clear that watching television, a lot of television, is not good for your happiness. And that basically happiness is about being active. It's about out there doing stuff, engaging with life, engaging with other people. And entertainment tends not to promote that. But here's another really interesting theory, again from evolutionary psychology, which is that when you look at our brain size and compare that with other primates, they can calculate our brain size because most of our brain is actually there, not because it's about intelligence in terms of making tools. It's about social intelligence. It's about being able to interact with other people. And the size of your cortex then is directly related to the size of the kind of groups you tend to live in. And basically, they can calculate that the kind of groups we should be theoretically living in, maximum size of which, from our ancestral environment, is about 100 to 200 people. Okay? Now, if you compare yourself with a group of 100 to 200 people, you're likely to find certainly many people in that group who are a bit more attractive than you, or a bit more sophisticated or charming than you, but they're not likely to be enormously more attractive than you in that small sample. Take the entertainment industry now. you're going to find on your television screen, of the 6 billion people on the planet, one or two of the most attractive of the 6 billion. And you're going to be comparing yourself with these incredibly startlingly attractive people. And Rich has written about this very eloquently in the book. Does that comparison process actually not have a corrosive effect? And one recent experiment found that when men, and it's interesting, it's always men, were shown magazine pictures of models of the opposite sex, and then asked to rate their commitment to their current relationship, their commitment was less just a few minutes after seeing pictures of models from magazines. So think about the cumulative corrosive effect of people comparing themselves with other people who appear to be doing a lot better. And again, Richard advocates that something should be done about that. I'm more uncomfortable about the idea of regulating this stuff. What I want to go down the route is of educating people as to the dangers of the entertainment industry and then leaving it to people to make decisions for themselves. But I think that we differ on that one.
Well, I don't mind. I don't want regulation. Oliver James, who's another psychologist, would like to have advertisements of women who are more beautiful than the average banned. How he's going to...
I think that was a very dangerous example,
going
Richard.
Going to work this out, I don't know. But I think some sort of general use of taxes... Where there's a problem, it seems to me perfectly okay. It doesn't infringe. Nobody feels any loss of autonomy as a result of it. But I did want to mention the fact that there is an experiment with women also, where women were shown pictures of models, and they felt a lot worse afterwards.
They felt worse about themselves in terms of their comparison with and in fact, the eating disorder symptomatology went up after seeing pictures of. Models. Mm. Certainly. So there is an interesting question about the corrosive effect on our happiness levels of the entertainment industry in general and the modern media. Lots of other questions. Do you want to?
You
choose.
Okay.
Just wanted to check. As I understand it, the main factors underlying happiness are things like health and physical security, and you mentioned employment, those kinds of things, as well as relationships. Mm. Now, in a modern developed society, how much scope, you know, what's the difference, what's the range between Switzerland and wherever in Western Europe, UK, US, wherever, is actually worst off, because it most of those societies will tend to have, it seems to me, very similar health, very similar employment rates even. So what's the scope for actual intervention to improve happiness?
No, they actually vary quite a lot. For example, this question I mentioned about trust, do you think most other people can be trusted? I think Norway was 60% said yes, and Brazil 7%. There's a big difference between societies. You shouldn't underestimated, and we can learn from it.
I want to pick up on that question and make another point, which is that going back to evolutionary systems in the brain that mediate emotions, I didn't have time to go into it in my talk, but a very important point is that there are two separate systems for desire, i.e. wanting stuff, and the system for enjoying stuff. And that has interesting implications. If they're two different systems. Because it sometimes means that sometimes the stuff we really want and desire and spend a lot of time pursuing, when we eventually get it, doesn't actually give us as much pleasure as we thought it would give us. And this is illustrated by a fascinating treatment that psychologists prescribe for unhappy people called pleasant activity training, or PAT for short. And it's very simple. All they do is they ask you to list the things that you enjoy doing most in your life, about 5 or 10 things. And after you've listed them, they say, right, we want you to do more of those things over the next few weeks. And lo and behold, when people do more of those things, they find themselves enormously happier. Okay, so which raises the question, well, why weren't they doing that in the first place? Well, the reason they weren't doing it was because often they were pursuing things. What they desired led them to pursue stuff. Often when they got that stuff, it didn't make them that much happier. So that raises an interesting question that, again, Richard brings up in his book, which is we need to worry a bit about the aspirations that a modern corporate capitalist society builds in, the desires it encourages, in that, does it put people on a hedonic treadmill, which is a term that psychologists use? Does it mean that people are constantly desiring stuff, and yet when they get it, they discover that it's not the kind of fulfilling thing they thought it was going to be all along, and they just then embark on yet another set of desires?
I've got very little contribution rather than a question, and I understand it's a debate, so I hope you'll be happy to accept this contribution to the debate. I work very practically with loads of people coordinating a global happiness campaign called the Gloom to Bloom Happiness Campaign. And what I have found, firstly, I'm going back to Professor Leah's point, that poor countries are less happy than rich countries. And you also mentioned the World Value Survey. I remember the report of the World Value Survey reported in 2003. Nigeria was the top of the league of 65 countries, so indicating that the happiest people seem to be in Nigeria. But if you then look at Nigerians in the United Kingdom and elsewhere in industrialized countries, you begin to question the primacy of the role of the state in actually promoting happiness. And from the global campaign which I coordinate, Gloom to Bloom, people from different parts of the world exchange happiness ideas, just simple ideas as regarding how to stay happy. I'm beginning to take a view that perhaps the single most important determinant of happiness is individual's choice and commitment. And from my own experience, in 2001, after a near-death experience, I signed a 4.5-page personal happiness contract drafted on my computer and got my two young sons to witness this. And I use this as positive energy because I know if you make a promise to children and you don't deliver, they'll pull you up on it. They were 9 and 11 then, and I signed the contract, got them to sign as witnesses. So if dad is not happy, remind me. And from the campaign I've been coordinating, people do, like you rightly said, very simple, practical things. And they ask feedback. For example, last Father's Day, I asked my children, am I a good dad? How would you assess me? And I'm happy to report that the assessment was significantly higher from 0 to 10. I got 10 this year, which is great. And I'm happy to share this. So I understand the state has a role to play. Last year, I did a small survey in the prison service, and 87% of prisoners responded saying unhappiness is the single most important cause of crimes.
Well, I want to pick up on that point. Bhutan, the Himalayan kingdom, has said recently that it's going to abandon gross national product as the measure of its progress as a society, and they're going to go for gross national happiness instead. And Richard raises the interesting question about how we judge governments and their performance, and whether we should move away a little bit from economic performance indicators and other indicators of just our general well-being, or the quality of well-being in a society at large. And I think it's a really interesting question.
Of course, the most surprising thing is that in the land of the free, where you wouldn't think the government would be interested, namely America, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is including questions about happiness for the next 4 years in its surveys, quite detailed ones. Because, I mean, it can't be a sensible approach to policy not to know who the elite happy people are in your society, how they're progressing, and in general how the society itself is progressing. The issue is how to ask the questions in a satisfactory way, and I have some sympathy for what was said here. Just one question is not a very adequate way of handling these things. And you may know that the Nobel Prize in Economics was given 2 years ago to a psychologist. This never happened before. Very good sign. And he has been very instrumental in developing more careful ways of measuring how people are experiencing their life and how they're feeling by repeated sampling and at different periods of day and so on. And I think that's the way the thing will have to go. But he and many psychologists in America are being rather successful in, they like to call it national happiness accounts. You see, it sounds right. The word account is very good. so they're making a lot of progress with this.
Well, I want to pick up on that point. It's very important because Daniel Kahneman was the person you're talking about, a psychologist who won the Nobel Prize for Economics. Now, his work actually has a very profound implication for the measurement of happiness. And just to summarize very briefly one of the studies he did, and again, I'm slightly surprised he got Ethics Committee approval, but basically he did a study where people had a colonoscopy, which is a very painful procedure. And in one condition, they had a colonoscopy which lasted a certain length of time, was extremely painful. In the second condition, they had exactly the same colonoscopy, the same length of time, but there was slightly less pain at the end of the procedure. They engineered it this way, but this is after the same length of time of pain had occurred as in the first condition. Remarkably, people in the second condition rated the second colonoscopy as less painful or more pleasant than the first. Yet objectively, they'd had as much pain. It just after the pain had gone by, they just had a slightly less painful experience right at the end. And the conclusion is that when people are asked to judge happiness, they often focus on the intensity of the experience, i.e. the peak bit of how awful it was, and then the end bit. Okay, and that maybe explain why people are often very unreliable in their judgment of happiness. And that may explain why very often they make bad decisions. They decide to pursue stuff that they think is going to make them happy, and then in the end they discover when they get there, it didn't make them as happy as they thought it would. And Daniel Gilbert, a professor of psychology at Harvard, has done a lot of work on how hopeless we are at predicting how happy certain things will make us. And he asked people to predict how happy they thought they would be depending on certain events, like getting a job or losing a job, and actually they were absolutely hopeless at predicting future happiness depending on certain events. And what's fascinating about that is every single decision we make is probably based on the idea that whatever we do, like going shopping or pursuing this job or doing this homework, we're factoring in how happy we think it's going to make us in the long run. And what Gilbert is saying is we're no good at that decision, which has really profound implications for basically every decision we make in life. And I want to go back to the point that I would be worried about governments saying, well, you know, you guys are really bad at this decision-making stuff. We're going to take over and help you with those decisions. I think people should be educated about the fact that they're error-prone when it comes to these decisions, but hopefully with that education, they'll be moved to a place where they can make better decisions over happiness.
Hang on.
I have two questions. The first one is for Mr. Layat. Do you think all the neurotics are born like that? Do you think all the mad people are born like that? Because I think some people are kind of, I'm not saying the society is the one to blame, but just look at England. How many children going to schools and get bullied and become so introverted, become such a kind of mental illness and in a way getting depressed? So I think in a way you're trying to get a solution. Okay, if we have so many mad people and neurotics and we're trying to give them psychiatric treatment or something, but why don't you think, how do you persuade government to channel the funds, let's say we have only a limited budget, instead of channel to how to reduce those people to become mental illness rather than give you the fund to do more psychiatric works? And this is my first question. The second one is on... to Dr. Raj, and it's on the two levels of happiness. It seems to me that a lot of people who are intellectually satisfied and trying to pursue the level two happiness, in the end, a lot of professional people are like that. And they're working people, they're intellectuals, and they get a certain stage in the society, maybe quite higher level. But then they realize, okay, we're not going to have children. So they kind of abandon the evolutionary responsibilities of the whole humankind. But those people who are in the level one happiness, those drunken people who tends to have one night stand and just have children like that. And what do you think of that? I think it seems to me the level one happiness kind of helped on the evolution process, which it shouldn't be like that.
Richard, I think this is okay. One for you.
I'll start on the genes. Of course, everything about us is a product of the interaction between the genes and our experience. And certainly in some of the psychotic conditions, the genes can have a very strong effect, as you can see from the behavior of identical twins separated at birth, one of whom becomes schizophrenic. There's a very high probability the other one will. But having said that, there is an important genetic component, especially in extreme problems of mental illness, and also to some extent in just our general level of cheerfulness, think about height. I mean, height is one of the most heritable of all characteristics, and yet the average height of the population has increased by, I think, something like 2 inches in the last 150 years. So the fact that something is subject to the influence of genes doesn't mean that we can't do something about it. And I agree very much with what I think you were saying, that if we can have a good childhood experience for people, that if they have a genetic weakness, it's much less likely to come out in their adult life than if they have terrible childhoods. So let's be good parents.
Well, very briefly, just to pick up on that point about mental illness, as a psychiatrist who works in the NHS at the Maudsley Hospital, I obviously engage on a daily basis with the treatment of mental illness. But it strikes me as very odd that we don't do more about the prevention of mental illness. And that's often because people make the mistake of thinking it's biological or it's genetic. A lot of heart disease is biological or genetic, but that doesn't mean that watching your diet and exercising regularly can't go a long way to preventing yourself having a heart attack. And the first book that I wrote, Staying Sane, was all about the idea that actually if we taught people the correct coping skills and what the psychology of resilience teaches us, then actually we could go a long way to preventing a lot of mental illness. And that the flaw at the heart of a lot of policy thinking is about the idea that you prevent mental illness by stopping bad things happening to people. And we should go a long way to try and prevent unnecessarily bad things happening to people, but it's a doomed project. Bad things will always happen to people, even in the best regulated of societies. Once that happens, the key question is, how can we cope best when a bad thing happens to us? And there's a huge amount of individual variability in coping skills. A lot of people, when a bad thing happens to them, go down with a bad case of depression or anxiety. Many people emerge unscathed. And it's that issue of individual variability in response that I would argue that economists often miss out, which is they would say, well, advertising tends to make people unhappy, or raising people's expectations may not be good for them. It's certainly not good or makes a large number of people unhappy, but there's individual variability in response. A lot of people aren't affected in a bad way, and we need to pay more attention to this individual variability. What are the people who are surviving bad things happening to them and doing fairly well, what are they doing that's different from the rest of us? And that's exactly the kind of project that I'm interested in, learning from the people who are performing well and doing well, and try to teach those skills to the rest of the population.
Yeah, someone up there, yes.
Hi. From what Dr. Poussard said, internal types are typically better at achieving level 2 happiness, yeah? Am I right in thinking that? Okay, so
you've certainly got the technical jargon straight away.
So I thought a valid question is, what makes people internal or external types? Now, to what extent is it inherited, and to what extent is it a feature of their environment that they develop into that type of person? And so I thought, although that argument might undermine the idea that the state has a role, because it might encourage people to be external, they might think, well, I can just blame the state if it all goes wrong. I thought actually what Professor Layard is talking about is creating an environment where people are more likely to be internal, because they don't see huge barriers outside which make them think, however hard I try as an individual to get somewhere, I'm just not going to be successful. And it kind of relates to the idea that it's a cutthroat society. You're trying to get ahead of someone else, but you know that it's no good because you can't get ahead of them. So the role of the state is actually to create an environment where people are likely to adopt an internal approach, and they do that because they're not in an environment where they see it as being a hopeless game anyway. Isn't that the point? In which case, your debate is kind of, you're sort of backing each other up in a way.
Well, I agree with you that I think that one of the key questions is, how do we help people be a little bit more internal in orientation? And incidentally, I don't think it's necessarily wise to always be internal. I think a certain amount of flexibility might be helpful. In other words, it might be helpful to switch to being quite external on certain occasions. Like if it really is the case that a really, really bad thing is happening to you, and actually it really wasn't your fault. The mistake that internals make is they often continue to make internal causal attributions of blame when actually it wasn't their fault. And the other thing they tend to do, and a lot of successful people do this, is they tend to try to control the uncontrollable. Okay, and if you want a guaranteed way of getting a season ticket to my clinic, then attempting to control the uncontrollable will certainly get you one of those. And perfectionistic people, people who work hard and people who are successful, often go beyond in terms of their beliefs about what they can control. And that's why they often land in psychological problems. So I'm not necessarily advocating that internality is superior to externality. What I'm saying is it depends on the context you find yourself in. I would argue that the decision algorithm is like this. You need to appraise your situation and then make a decision as to which route to go down, depending on the context you find yourself in. But I agree completely that what the state needs to do is try to encourage a certain amount of internality and make people believe that they can make a difference. And let me just briefly conclude with another interesting theory about why there are rising levels of externality in society, and it's about the TV news. It's about the idea that when people watch the TV news, they see major events going on in the world around them, and they feel unable to have an impact on those events. Whereas again, thousands of years ago, when we lived in communities of just 150, 200 people, then whatever happened around you, i.e. the equivalent of the TV news, was stuff you could do something about, you could have an impact on, and that maybe the TV news disempowers people. And that leads to the idea that maybe one of the things that could really encourage more internality is if we encourage more local politics, if people got more involved at a local level in making a difference to their local community, and that, that local politics was encouraged, would be very helpful in that direction.
Yes, I mean, there's this extraordinary study in Switzerland. You know, in Switzerland, they have local referenda in the different cantons, but the cantons differ in the extent to which they have these referenda, and you have a right to demand a referendum and so on. And they found that huge differences in happiness across cantons that correspond to the extent to which you have this local autonomy.
I understand your position is that you think educating people to cope better is very important, but you don't want the state to intervene very much. And I think, in some sense, I find it your interests fit your role as a psychiatrist, but in some sense, as a psychiatrist, I should think you would want the state to do more. I mean, if I take an extreme example, there are people who survived Auschwitz fairly intact psychologically, and I can see as a psychiatrist why you would be very interested in how they did that. But clearly, you know, it doesn't mean that we don't want to try and prevent another Auschwitz because some people can somehow survive it. And that's a very, very extreme example, but maybe in some sense, let's say, limiting advertising is, you know, makes a society in which it is easier to be happy, because if you have a society which is very competitive and lots of this advertising and so on, then some people will still cope with that very well and will be very happy. But isn't it, as a psychiatrist, don't you think that that is actually a situation in which it's much harder and you need much better internal coping strategies and much stronger, so it puts much more demands on you as an individual to be happy in that society? And therefore, you know, it would make, you know, it just, you know, if that is the case, then I should think that as a psychiatrist, you would actually want to say, you know, we can't really demand from people to be so good, and therefore we should, you know, we should try for the state to do something more. You know, we can't demand people to be perfect and be happy in any situation.
Well, I certainly think, like Richard advocates very polemically in his book, we should be spending more on mental health services, and we should be spending more in the National Health Service in terms of providing treatment for the seriously mentally ill. And I'm certainly against really, really bad things happening. I didn't realize I'm going to have to make a declaration that I was against the whole Auschwitz thing, but maybe I should go on the record and say that. But at the same time, I'm trying to alert you to the danger of the idea that the state should always be there as a kind of massive, infinite safety net to bail people out of trouble. And that's the problem, which is I think it should be there, and it should be better funded than it is at the moment. But maybe the best agents to help people prevent themselves getting into trouble are people themselves, and we need to equip them with the intellectual and emotional tools to do that. It is still the case that some people will end up in trouble, and there should be a safety net. There's no doubt about that, and a safety net that's better funded and more efficient than the one that we have now. But does that mean the safety net should be infinite in size? Because that really does raise a deep question about taxation policy and how much your economy can cope. The debate really is about the limits to the extent of the safety net. But my point is that people are trying to limit the safety net, but they're not trying to put in place other things whereby we could equip individuals to help themselves. And those things, we know, the research exists already. We know what the greatest coping skills are that would help prevent mental illness. That's not being taught in schools. We have a small project at the Maudsley Hospital where I work, where every summer we get local school students in and we teach them coping skills, actually, as an attempt to start that project going.
This should probably be the last.
Oh, that puts a lot of pressure on me.
Make it a good one.
I'll try. I'm a bit confused. Maybe you can help me. Professor Layard, you traced a graph on a white piece of paper which showed the relationship between income and happiness. And what you showed was that it kind of rises at lower levels of income and then flattens out. Yet politicians in the West, which one would assume are where the income levels are highest, seem to behave in a way where they seem to be focused on GDP maximization. The two of you mentioned Bhutan, which I can't speak of, and the country you described as the land of the free, which I grew up in, where politicians seem to be positively obsessed with GDP growth. And it seems odd that they should be advanced in measuring happiness, yet focused not on happiness but on GDP growth. Why are politicians in the West acting so irrationally? All right, it's not a good question. But
I'm not sure. Did you understand that?
Well, yeah. Let me try this.
Yes, but I'm a
psychiatrist. Question's really simple.
No. I did understand the question. I think, which is about, it, in a way, it doesn't make sense that politicians are pursuing the economic growth model,
especially in the West, where it seems there's no correlation between happiness and income level.
Yeah, but this goes back to the interesting question about what we think we desire, and in a way, politicians are trying to pander to that. And again, what's really important about Richard's book is he's putting that question right back at the center stage of public policy, which is, what should we desire? And we just had a general election campaign. And in a way, there's a sense in which people skate over that question and make implicit assumptions about that. And that's because we think we're good at that kind of decision making. We think we're good at the idea that because we desire a second house or a bigger car or a different commute, that we are making the right decision. The evidence is that very often we make those decisions, we arrive at the end state, and actually it doesn't produce the well-being that we thought it would. And I think that means that maybe we should be thinking about a key part of education should be about these issues, about these psychological issues. It's fascinating to me that you get taught algebra at school, for example. I don't know about you, but I've never used algebra since I left school. And yet we don't get taught things like coping skills, how to make better decisions, etc., etc. And might the educational project be something where some of this stuff should be in, I think.
Yeah, let me offer a thought about politicians. I think it's quite difficult to get anything done if you're a politician. So how do you sort of mobilize a situation in which you can get something done? You make people feel scared that the existing situation is untenable. You tell them life is really tough. You tell them there's almost insuperable threat from India and China. Unless they get off their back seats, they're going to be at the same income level as India and China. I mean, a lot of this is sort of tales to frighten the children. And it's kind of understandable that politicians would try and generate this sort of anxieties in order to get their reforms through. It's understandable employers would try and generate these kind of anxieties in order to get change in their businesses. But I think, in a way, that...
Oh, thanks.
Sorry about that, Roger. I think that perhaps in a way, the most important point I was trying to make in my book is, what is our true situation? Our true situation is that we are inexorably becoming richer all the time. Two forces: one, science, that's the most important, but also actually globalization is bringing products to us cheaper than we ever had them before, raising our incomes. Of course, there's a little threat to some particular industries, but in general, this process, as we know from hundreds of years of history of trade, is a major source of higher income. So if we now have this ability to be richer and richer and richer, the issue is how should we use it? Should we say to ourselves, and this is the extraordinary thing which is going on, well, we may be becoming 2% richer a year, but my God, it's got to be 2.25%, because otherwise we somehow everything is going to fall apart. Or should we say, no, I mean, 2% is pretty good. In fact, I mean, if we could be a little more secure, which we know is what people want, why don't we even take 1.75%? Instead of which, we are subjected to a barrage, a sort of ideological barrage, largely coming across the Atlantic, that everything's got to be more competitive, that there must be, if I can just take a little tilt at you, there's got to be more and more personal choice in respect of everything. For example, if you've got to, I mean, we happen not to have in England, but in most countries, they have a functioning pension system, public pension system. If you've got that, no, you should take responsibility for your own pension. To put more and more pressure on people to feel that nothing is going to be just okay, because that's the way it has been, that they're going to have to handle the unknown and the unforeseeable increasingly. And now you've got this extraordinary view, which is obviously completely wrong, that there are many people, according to the surveys, say people in their late teens or early 20s, who think they're not going to be as rich as their parents. I mean, this is completely fatuous. It's inconceivable that that should come about. And yet, this is the atmosphere of fear and anxiety that's been created. And the idea that it's perfectly okay to want to be secure and let's help people to be secure is being derided, you might almost say, in many of the speeches of our of the leaders of the Western world. So that's what I'm against. I think that unprecedented riches should be used to give us the things which we want, which include security.
Can I just make a closing comment then, which kind of endorses that, and go back to the point about politicians? I actually think politicians are being rather clever psychologically, because one of the things they've understood, if you look at the evolutionary psychology of emotion, it makes sense that negative emotions like fear and anxiety are actually emotions that tend to grab us and hold on to us more than positive emotions, because fear and anxiety kept us alive thousands of years ago, because if you didn't feel fear and anxiety when a lion was bounding towards you, your life ended kind of rapidly. And it made sense, therefore, that fear and anxiety were very arresting emotions, and that we were vigilant, and if there was a possibility of fear and anxiety, we would latch on to that. So there's a natural biological tendency to orientate ourselves towards negative emotions. And politicians have understood that, which is why they use fear in election campaigns. They make you frightened of the asylum seekers, or Iraq, or the Russians, or the communists. And that's how they get you to mobilize, to vote. And wouldn't it be great if instead of this use of fear, which makes evolutionary sense, but actually in modern-day society doesn't make sense, that we had politicians that pandered more or encouraged more, that we thought about positive emotions, like happiness and well-being, and encouraged ourselves to orientate ourselves towards positive emotions, like well-being, and that we voted on that rather than voting on fear.
What a perfect ending. Well, thank you all very much for your questions. I think it's been a very, very nice debate. Thank you.